Good evening. My name's Taranita. It's very nice to see you all, so many of you. It's lovely. So this talk, then, is going to be about, it's entitled, Buddha's Life as a Journey of Integration. So the Buddha's Life as a Journey of Integration. And it's going to deal with horizontal and vertical integration. And of course, this is the seventh week of this series. So we've been talking quite a lot about integration so far in the series. And as kind of Arpi has said, this is the penultimate week. Next week, we have the culminating puja along with Sarah's farewell. So this is the one but last week. And I'm going to look at some texts from the Pali Canon, which is the teachings that go back to the time of the Buddha, as far as we're aware. We can be reasonably confident that these date back to the time of the Buddha. So let's just recap then, because we've covered a lot of ground during these series of integration. So horizontal integration first. So this is bringing together the various different aspects of our personality, such as our introvert part, our extrovert part, various different archetypes or personas that we may adopt or fit into from time to time. It's bringing them together so that they are in some sort of relationship and not isolated from one another. So I've got an example of this. So my wife's friend, Jan, you don't know her, she's just changed her job. And in theory, it should be a very similar job. It's doing the same sort of thing, but in a different place. She was made redundant, but she got this new job. She was very happy where she was, but she's very unhappy where she is right now. And that's because, mostly because her boss is a bit difficult, a bit awkward, sort of talks down to her, a bit of a bully, not very nice, generally a bit unpleasant. And so Jan has, her response to that has been largely to internalise that. And she's a very angry person at the best of times, to be frank. And so she's quite angry and very stressed, to be honest, and very unhappy. And the danger is, well, that's not good either, but the danger is that she might explode at some point and ram this woman's head into the washing machine or something like that. She works in the laundry, you see. So that's a possibility, a distinct possibility. So the upshot is, you know, there's not much integration going on there. She has these isolated sort of pockets, and I suppose one way, if we were integrated, well integrated in that situation, one could bring together the emotional responses, and her emotional response, whether it's skillful or unskillful, I don't want to get into that, but it's to be unhappy when you're treated like that is quite understandable, to feel maybe some resentment or certainly to feel not well treated. That's not an unreasonable response, quite an understandable response. So ideally, that emotional response would be able to communicate with the more rational side, the more intellectual side, and think about the possible ways that you could move the situation forward. Maybe you could decide, well, I'll put up with it. Maybe you'll decide, well, I'm going to look for another job, but in the meantime, I'll put up with it. Or maybe you'll decide, no, I don't want to be treated like that anymore. I'm going to hand them a notice and then find something else. Or maybe you try to speak to this woman and reason with her. Or maybe you decide that isn't possible. But either way, you know, if you were well integrated, then maybe you could bring together the more rational side and the emotional side and come to a decision as to the best way forward. So integration can be very helpful in many ways, and that's one example. And by building insight into the nature of our being, by seeing these different aspects of ourselves and bringing them into relationship, it helps us to see through the idea of a monolithic, homogeneous self. We can see that we've got all these different bits and characteristics that change and are dynamic and flow over time. And so it can be an insight experience in horizontal integration. Vertical integration, on the other hand, brings together our highs and our lows. So this could be, we could have amazing experiences. Quite often it might be in meditation. Of course, you may not have amazing experiences in meditation, but a lot of people do sometimes, or indeed outside of meditation. Maybe some sort of insight experiences that helps us to see through the nature of ourselves. And I think really we all do have these sort of experiences in some way, shape or form. But what do we do then with these experiences? We could say to ourselves, oh, well, it can't really be an insight experience because I'm not experienced enough, I'm not, you know, spiritual enough. It's really not that sort of thing. It can't be very worthy. On the other hand, we could cling to them as some sort of badge of honour. I've had this amazing meditation experiences, you know, how spiritual I must be, how much progress I have made. So we could do that. Or alternatively, on having such experiences, we can let them change us, let them percolate through us over perhaps a period of time. And this would be vertical integration, letting those highs come into contact with the rest of our being. And then what about the lows? Well, we all have selfish aspects to ourselves, because we all have, to some extent, until we get enlightened, we all have some idea of ourselves as a fixed entity, a fixed, fairly isolated entity. And therefore, by definition, we will be, to an extent, selfish at some times. But it's no good denying that. There's no good pretending that they don't exist. If we do that, then how are we ever going to change them? So, again, we need to bring this into our experience, both the highs and the lows, become aware of them all and allow them to all become integrated. Now, so we've been looking at this for 6 weeks. This is the seventh week. And we've covered quite a lot of ground, isn't there? There's a lot to it, really, potentially. And it all may be seeming like there's quite a bit of trouble, really. But fear not, because when I was doing some research for this talk, I came along on the internet the tachyonized personal cocoon vertical integration meditation system, which sounds like it saves a lot of time, doesn't it, really, rather than all this Buddhist theory. So we could just get ourselves a tachyonized personal cocoon vertical integration meditation system and use that instead. And let me tell you something about it. First of all, you get tachyonized cocoon strips with Velcro, which are basically just sort of, well, strips about the width of a quesar, just long ones, and you lie down on the ground and you fold over the tachyonized cocoon strips over your head and through your legs, join them together so it's in a band around you as you lay down. And then you get your tachyonized eye pillow, which you obviously put over your eyes. I guess you could, you know, you could use those ones you get on an aeroplane, I suppose, but they're not tachyonized. So. And then you get your tachyonized silica discs, four of those, which do look a little bit like CDs, if you remember those. And what you do, you let down, you've got your strips over, you've got your eye mask on, and then you put your hands down on the two of the tachyonized silica discs. And you get special socks as well. you put one of these discs in each socks, put the socks on, and so you've got your hands and your feet in contact with the tachyonized silica discs at all times while you meditate. And then you meditate, and there you are, instant vertical integration.
I think he should do the warm-up act for the skills auction.
So that's a tachyonized personal cocoon vertical integration meditation system, and I have seen them on the internet for as little as $400, so it's a snip. However, having said that, I'm not going to focus too much on the tachyonized personal cocoon vertical integration meditation system for the rest of my talk, because although I'm not an expert on the Pali Canon, I don't think it cropped up very much in there, and I don't think it was something the Buddha really relied on. So we'll draw a veil over that for now. So what I am going to do, though, during the rest of this talk, is I've got some snippets from the Pali Canon, which I think illustrate some of the integration or lack of integration that took place in the career of Siddhartha Gautama, and afterwards, once he became enlightened, the Buddha. So I'll press on with that now then. So first of all, this one is called the first meditation. So the first meditation. It was a day of the first ploughing of the fields when Siddhartha, who was the boy who would grow up to become, over a process of time, the Buddha, when Siddhartha was 9, King Suddhodana, his royal family and all his ministers attended the ceremony. In the field, a man naked to the waist was prodding a water buffalo to pull a plough. It was very close to noon and the sun shone down relentlessly on his bare back. He was sweating profusely and visibly tired from walking up and down in the fields making the furrows. Intermittently, he would whip the reluctant buffalo. The buffalo had to pull very hard and with the yoke upon its body. Its hooves gripped the ground because as its large body inched forward, dragging the heavy plough behind it. The plough turned up the soil, exposing the worms that made their homes there. The worms wriggled in distress, trying desperately to find cover. Other worms writhed in pain, as they had just been cut in halves. Siddhartha then realized why so many birds were hovering near the ground. They were eating the live, defenseless worms and other tiny bugs that lay bare for easy picking. Just then a hawk swooped down and caught one of the small birds. With its lunch secured in its claws, it took to the air again, giving out the loud cry of a master of the sky. Siddhartha watched in silence. He felt the toil of the man who ploughed the field in the hot sun. He felt the struggle of the water buffalo chained to the plough. He felt the pain of the worms cut by the plough. It was heart-wrenching to witness the worms, the insects and the small bird losing their lives so abruptly. Siddhartha felt their fear, their pain and the unpredictability of life itself. He took shelter under a rose apple tree. He sat down and straightened his body to gather his breath. With his eyes lowered, Siddhartha reflected on the scene that has transpired in the field. After sitting quietly for a while, Siddhartha noticed that his thoughts subsided. He experienced a calm and clear awareness from within. He recognized that the man, the water buffalo, the birds, and the worms had one thing in common. Each of them was tied to the conditions of its life. Siddhartha continued to look deeper. He recognized that the conditions brought fear and pain at times, and enjoyment at others, regardless of what conditions they were born with. All living things wanted to live in peace and happiness. All living things wanted to avoid suffering. All living things were thus interconnected with one another through this universal wish to be happy. A very strong conviction then seized Siddhartha. If he wanted to help others, he would need first to find out for himself how he could help. He needed to understand the nature of the conditions that created suffering. Only then would he be able to change them so that every living thing could enjoy happiness. Siddhartha! Someone shook the prince's shoulder. King Suddhodana and Queen Gotami both saw Siddhartha sitting under the tree. The queen was in awe of the fact that a 9-year-old could sit in a meditation posture so serenely. However, the king's facial expression tensed up right away. In his heart, his greatest fear was taking shape, that Siddhartha would leave him one day in search of the truth. So in order to distract him, the king built Siddhartha a beautiful palace with a lovely garden to play in. But this did not stop the prince from thinking about the suffering and unhappiness that he noticed around him. In this text, we see both the highs and the lows, the sadness and the fear and the helplessness, leading to an understanding and a determination, though perhaps also with some stress and depression, but not resignation. So this is an important episode, as it was important to Siddhartha himself as he reflected on it and recalled it as he himself was approaching enlightenment. But it didn't lead to him getting enlightened there and then. I mean, he was a 9-year-old boy. Although he had this insight experience, he was able to see something of the nature of existence and something of the path that he may need to follow. Nevertheless, it wasn't a fully integrated experience at that time, which is quite understandable because often that is the way of things, that we may have some little insight or big insight, But it takes a period of time to percolate through our bodies, through our beings, through our mental states, through our intellect, and through our emotional bodies. So there was much more work that Siddhartha had to do in order to integrate that experience and deepen that experience. So this next text is from... this is from the Padana Sutta, the Great Struggle. Now in this, you may have heard of Mara, who's the kind of embodiment of unskillfulness in some ways, of obstacles and so forth. But he's got lots of different names, Mara, much like the devil in Christian texts. So, and he often pops up from time to time in the Pali Canon, a lot of times actually. And it can be said to represent, it works very well if you think of it as representing an aspect of the Buddha's own persona. It's a bit like, you know, those cartoons where you have somebody in there pondering what to do, and on one side they've got like an angel, and the other side they've got a devil. And the angel says something to them, oh, you know, you should do this, that. And the devil says, no, you don't want to do that, you want to do this. You know, the sort of things I mean. Yeah. But it's a bit like that, in a sense. You know, it could be this aspect of the Buddha's personality, or at this stage, Siddhartha, I should say. He's not enlightened at this stage. An aspect of his personality speaking to him. And it works quite well, if we think of it in those terms. In this particular text, Mara is known as Namuchi. So when near the river Niranjara, I exerted myself in meditation for attaining to security from bondage, there came Namuchi, speaking words of compassion. You are emaciated and ill-looking. You are near to death. 1,000 parts of you belong to death, and only a fraction of you is alive. Live, good sir. It is better to live. Living, you may perform meritorious deeds. From practicing celibacy and tending the sacrificial fire, much merit is made. But what is obtained from striving? It is difficult to enter the path of exertion. It is difficult to do, difficult to maintain. Mara spoke these words while standing in the presence of the awakened one. To Mara speaking thus, the Lord replied, you who are a friend of the negligent, O evil one, for what reason have you come here? Those who still have use for merit, Mara may consider worthwhile addressing. I have faith and energy and wisdom. Being thus bent on striving, why do you ask me to live? This wind will wither the currents of the rivers. Why should not my exertion dry up even the blood? When the blood dries up, the bile and phlegm wither. On the wasting away of the flesh, the mind becomes more and more serene. My mindfulness, wisdom, and concentration are established more firmly. In me, who abides, enduring such an extreme experience, the mind does not long for sensual pleasures. See the purity of a being. Sensual desire is your first army. The second is called discontent. The third is hunger and thirst. The fourth, craving. The fifth, sluggishness and laziness. The sixth, fear. The seventh, indecision. And the eighth, disparagement of others and stubbornness. Gain, fame, honour, prestige wrongly acquired, and whoever praises himself and despises others. These, Namuchi, are your armies, the dark ones striking forces. A lazy, cowardly person cannot overcome them, but by conquering them one gains bliss. I wear munja grass. Now, as it turns out, Indian warriors used to wear munja grass on their head or in their headgear, and this was a symbol that they were prepared to die in battle. So, I wear munja grass. Shame on life here in this world. It is better for me to die in battle than live defeated. Some recluses and Brahmins are not seen exerting themselves here, so immersed are they in worldliness. They are not aware of that path by which those of perfect conduct walk. So we could see in this particular dialogue different elements of Siddhartha's psyche in competition. Clearly, some part of Siddhartha's being was sick to death with all this striving, with all this hard work, with all this doing without food, doing without pleasure, so on and so forth. And again, this is completely understandable. I'm sure whilst we might not have exerted ourselves in quite the same way or anything like the same way as the Buddha, certainly speaking for myself. Nevertheless, at times you can feel a bit fed up of exertion and wanting to let go of it sometimes. So that kind of response is perfectly understandable, I think. And that part of Siddhartha's being was looking for an excuse to let go of this path of striving. But Siddhartha was able to counter this by bringing in into his consciousness his more determined aspects, recalling what his purpose was, maybe going back to that very first meditation and the thoughts that he's had, the reflections that he's had following this. And so renew his commitment and, in that sense, banish Mara. He came to a decision to continue. So, as it is understandable that these sort of protestations from ourselves should emerge from time to time, we should bring them to being and not simply deny them. But one other thing that I find interesting in this particular discussion is, you remember the Buddha's all about the middle way, isn't he? You know, he's a big fan of the middle way. In this particular talk, he seems to veer quite close to the more hard line side of the middle way, I would have thought. But then this is pre-enlightenment, so he's still, I guess, finding his way. But he does come out with some pretty tough talking there to see off Namuchi. So the next excerpt, actually I'm not going to read an excerpt, I'm just going to summarise, is from the time of the Enlightenment. And Subhadramati spoke about this 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I'm just going to go through it very, very briefly. But you may recall that on the day leading up to the evening when Siddhartha became enlightened, Mara once again appeared and tried once again to head off Siddhartha, to prevent him from getting enlightened. And so he did this by, first of all, bringing forth his beautiful daughters to try and elicit some sort of sensual response, some craving in Siddhartha. When that failed, he brought forth his warriors who tried to frighten and anger Siddhartha. And then Mara claimed that the seat of enlightenment rightly belonged to him, to Mara, and not to this, you know, mere human being. And Mara's monstrous soldiers cried out together, "I am his witness." So Mara challenged Siddhartha, "You know, who will speak for you then?" Thinking that he just sat there all alone under the tree on his own. And of course, as we may know, the earth goddess rose up out of the ground and said that, yes, she indeed witnessed Siddhartha striving through many, many lifetimes. And again, of course, Mara was banished. And we can see in this perhaps the last vestiges of Siddhartha's sensual desire, his fear, his insecurity. And they're being, it's almost like he was holding them up to the light and examining them and seeing what was left, bringing them into awareness, so that they could be fully integrated along with everything else. So Mara was overcome. These unskillful aspects were overcome, not by force, but by convincing argument, by reason, by experience, and by emotion. So moving on then to the final reading that I have. This is from the Raja Sutta, which is about rulership. As it turns out, it seems that there's a number of different suttas with a very, very similar name, but this is one in particular, Raja Sutta. So in this sutta, the Buddha is contemplating whether it is possible to rule righteously. Is it possible to exercise rulership without killing or causing others to kill, without confiscating or causing others to confiscate, without sorrowing or causing others to sorrow, righteously? Mara pounced on this thought. She's always hanging about, isn't he, waiting to pounce on any sort of unskillfulness that might pop into your mind. Mara pounced on this thought. Exercise rulership, blessed one. Exercise rulership, O one well gone. Without killing or causing others to kill, without confiscating or causing others to confiscate, without sorrowing or causing others sorrow, righteously. Lord, the Blessed One has developed the four bases of power, pursued them, handed them the reins and taken them as a basis, given them a grounding, steadied them, consolidated them, and undertaken them well. So Amara's quite sneaky here, isn't he? He's a tricksy kind of a character, really. He attempts to feed the Buddha's urge to rule by, or thought of ruling, by flattery, and then by insinuating that it would be for the overall good if he were to do so. So you take on rulership, you take on some secular power, everybody's going to benefit, aren't they? Because you'll rule wisely, you do good things, you know. Everybody's a winner. But of course he knew that in reality, that what would really happen is, this: if he did take on secular power, this would likely corrupt him. As they say, you know, power corrupts. And imagine how easy it would have been for the Buddha to do that, to take advantage of his position and to have a much easier life, rather than 50 years of wandering around with hardly any possessions, on foot, trying to teach people the Dharma. He could have had a much easier life. He could have become the leader of some sort of cult, where he just sits around in nice surroundings and people just bring him offerings and food and so on, and come and ask him questions and so forth. Or he could have easily taken service in the court of one of the kings. He did speak to the kings, he had a relationship with the kings, so he could have taken that to the next level and become their spiritual advisor or their confessor, and still had the visage of a spiritual person, but really have a much more luxurious lifestyle, you know, living in relative luxury, and whilst being a man regarded as a man still of unsurpassed spiritual attainment. So it would have been very easy, I think, for him to have taken some secular power in addition to the spiritual leadership that he had of the Sangha. But as I'm sure he realised that this could have been problematic and would have led to some sort of corruption. But in keeping his simple lifestyle, he maintained his spiritual accomplishment. I suppose it's worth thinking about, though, would an enlightened being have been subject to such suggestions by their devotees? Because I'm sure many of his devotees, his disciples, would have come up to him and said, you know, perhaps you could do this, Lord, perhaps you could do that. Or king's representatives would have come up to him and said, well, perhaps you could come and work for me. You know, you can have money, you can have clothes, you can have food. You could still be spiritual, of course you could. But would he have been subject to these temptations as an enlightened being? It seems to me that an enlightened being would clearly have to have full awareness of their heights and their depths, all of the temptations to which they may be subject, and to be able to bring all such things into full consciousness without deluding oneself, so that they can be reviewed, assessed, and acted upon as necessary. So we all need to be aware of our highs and our lows, acknowledging our highs and our lows. Need to value any insight experiences. And we do, after all have insight experiences of various different forms, without glorification. And we also need to acknowledge our unskillful sides, our temptations for selfishness, even when they're disguised with good intent. So bringing all these aspects of ourselves into relationship. So, just to summarise then, by bringing all these aspects of ourselves into relationship, by integration, we can transcend them all by realising them to be ultimately empty. Thank you.